So it's not important that you follow all of the details, but that you see that this happens. It's a process which we can explain, and also how exquisitely the RNA is formatted and set up for this process to take place. Yeah?
I've heard of non-LPR retroalanine.
We're going to come to those in a second.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a small question. Is it just a coincidence that this transfer RNA normally has a different function, happens to also be a primer?
No, it's not a coincidence. Biological systems use molecules all the time for different functions. The translation factor is part of the Q-beta replicase in E. coli. Each retrovirus has its own specific tRNA that it uses as a primer. So they all use a tRNA primer, but they don't all use the same tRNA. And how that is picked up, identified, and encapsulated in the particle is something that I don't know much about, and I don't know whether it's been extensively studied or not.
And is the amino acid of that tRNA associated with this capsid, it has no direct connection with capsid?
Not as far as we know. Okay? And these kinds of LTR elements are found all the way from yeast, where they're called TY elements, up through us, where there are various kinds of retroviruses, and we have various kinds of endogenous retroviruses called ERVs. And these are present in our genome and in the genome of, I think, just about all mammals and perhaps all vertebrates as well. This is simply a picture, again, from Lewin's book. And what it says is you cleave the ends of the double-stranded DNA at each LTR to expose a 3' hydroxyl on each strand, which is exactly what you do with phage mu. You cut the target in a staggered cut, which is anywhere from 2 to 6 base pairs, characteristic of each retrovirus, to leave a 5' end, and they're ligated together. And as I said, that's chemically and genetically the same kind of reaction. And then, of course, these 2 base pairs are chewed away. There's replication, which creates the target duplication, and you end up with a fully inserted provirus flanked by the target duplication.
It's called a provirus, so the protovirus is no shell or otherwise.
It's DNA. And the virus is a lipid-coated particle containing 2 copies of the RNA, tRNAs. Other cellular RNAs can be incorporated into it and sometimes can end up as part of the retrovirus. That is, they can be transduced from by incorporation into the RNA. So this is now a provirus. The concept of provirus comes from study of temperate phages in bacteria and was originated by Lavoff and his students Jacob and Vollmann when they found that you could create a bacterial strain capable of producing a virus, but where no virus particles could be detected for dozens of generations. Okay? So HIV, one of the reasons it's so difficult to deal with, of course, is it exists in the chromosomes of cells of the immune system, even when virus is not being produced, and it goes latent, and then much later on, of course, it can be transcribed, and then viral particles can be produced. And the LTRs are full of all kinds of transcriptional regulatory signals, promoters, enhancers, and so forth. Now, the other elements that were just asked about are called non-LTR elements. These are probably far more ancient than the LTR-containing elements. And the active ones, or the ones which encode their own proteins for mobility, are called lines for long interspersed nucleotide elements. They were named before it was realized that they go through reverse transcription. And they, again, are found in just about all eukaryotes, but I'm not sure that we have evidence for them, certainly in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I don't know about other yeast. The non-LTR elements are transcribed Well, it says here the line elements are transcribed by RNA pol 2. Certainly, there are other elements that are mobilized by this that are transcribed by pol 3. The promoter, since there aren't no terminal repeats, has to be internal here, and it says it's located within this ORF in the 5' region, which is not translated. They don't have LTRs, and they have coding capacity, and actually they can encode a reverse transcriptase activity, and ORF1, which isn't identified here, encodes an endonuclease activity, and we'll see how that plays a role in the mobility of these elements. And at the ends, they encode typically an A-rich tract. It may contain some T's, but it's like indicating that this has been a messenger RNA and has been polyadenylated. And these elements are flanked by sequence duplications, which go anywhere from 2 or 3 base pairs to 25 or 30 base pairs in length. They're not always the same as they are with the LTR-type elements, so they're variable. And frequently, this looks like a cDNA that you might have cloned, that is, the 3' end is always there, but the elements are often deleted or truncated at the 5' end, as though you went along reverse transcribing, but after a while it stopped, and this is what happened in the early days of making cDNAs, and the 5' end is not there. So you find these elements frequently 5' deleted and defective. Now, the way line elements appear to work, and this is less well studied than the LTR elements, is that the endonuclease activity makes a double-strand break in the DNA. This all must be held together in some kind of complex, which isn't known. But when you break the DNA, you generate a 3' hydroxyl, which then allows the reverse transcriptase to copy the RNA into a DNA strand. And the DNA strand is reverse transcribed, and then the RNA is chewed away in ways that we still don't know in detail, and the second DNA strand is synthesized, and then the 3' hydroxyl here can be ligated to a 5' phosphate there, and you can insert this molecule with nicks in the other strands, which apparently are chewed away, and then this is inserted. There's a lot of detail missing here because it just isn't all that well understood. All right? Yeah.
One of the things I think of these director elements, the thing I've heard is that they need to have things like integrase and reverse transcriptase or whatever, because that's not in the normal eukaryotic cell, and they can think that the other things that are. But if we have all these retro elements around, it would seem that there would be lots of integrase around, lots of reverse transcriptase around, so it would seem any particular element could easily lose its reverse transcriptase, lose its integrase, and still be fine. On other elements.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happens. And I'm going to talk in just a minute about signs, which are short interspersed nucleotide elements that don't code reverse transcriptase, and that, as far as we know, depend upon the reverse transcriptase and nuclease activities encoded by the lines to move around. All right? And, of course, we know with DNA elements, we've known it all the way from the studies of McClintock back in the 40s and 50s, that defective DNA elements can be mobilized by complete DNA elements. Okay? So you get families of dependent mobile elements and autonomous mobile elements. And the dependent elements, of course, as the name implies, depend upon the autonomous elements. One of the ideas that's put forward in the Nature paper on the human genome about why the DNA elements or older families of retroelements go extinct is that the dependent elements finally overwhelm the autonomous elements, and the autonomous elements are lost. then everything goes quiet. And one of the important things to remember, and this is key in thinking about how these guys might work in evolution, is that you don't want them working all the time. When the genome is functioning well, you don't want rearrangements and changes. So these elements are quiet. It's only at moments of crisis, when the genome is not capable of ensuring normal replication, that you need these things for genomic restructuring. And there is lots and lots of experimental evidence in many different systems that crisis activates elements which were previously inactive. And it goes all the way back again to McClintock's pioneering studies in maize. Okay, now the sign elements are different from the line elements, that they're copied from short POL3 transcribed RNAs. And they're copies of small structural RNAs. Most of them are copies of tRNAs or some derivative of tRNAs. The ALUs, which are the most abundant sequence class in our genomes, are copied from the 7S RNA that I mentioned yesterday, which is involved in protein transport in the signal recognition particle. And they're a sort of partial dimer of it. So here is part of the 7S sequence, a poly-A tail, another part of it, another poly-A tail, flanked by a direct repeat. And these sign elements do not encode proteins. They don't encode proteins. They do have sequence, which, as you will see later, can become part of protein coding sequences. And they apparently depend upon line elements for their mobility. And the evidence for that is simply that the 3' end looks similar, and the pattern of sequence duplications at the ends are very similar to those seen around the line elements. We do have an experimental system where we can study line elements. There's a hybrid dysgenesis phenomenon in Drosophila called the IR system, using factors called I factors, which are in fact line elements. And so there's a whole genetic system which can and has been analyzed. And we know that defective I factors can be mobilized by complete I factor. So it shows that relationship between the defective or dependent elements and the complete elements. Now, let's just look at how abundant these things are. There are estimated, in the draft sequence, they've got 1,400,000 signs altogether, of which over 1 million are ALUs, and they estimate that there's close to 2 million signs altogether, which is 12.5% of the total genome. That's really quite amazing. The line elements are much bigger. They're several KB. These ALU and other signs are on the order of 100 to 200 base pairs. And so if there's 1 million lines altogether, of which almost 700,000 are L1s, they comprise almost, 18.9% of the genome, and L1 itself is 15% of the genome. It's hard to argue that retrotransposable elements have not played a very important role in the evolution of our genome. And one of the things that distinguishes us from mice is that we have more DNA in introns and between genes, if you will, and we have more copies of these retrotransposons. The DNA elements are less abundant. They're only 2.7%, but that's a lot of DNA still. The LTR-containing elements are about 8%, and there are other elements that are about 0.1. According to this, it's 42.5%. This table, the genome paper, I think, puts it at 45%. And remember, I told you that there's still another 17% of repetitive DNA that's not even included in the sequence because it's hard to sequence.
The units here are base pairs?
When it says percent of the genome, it means, yes, it's the percent.
No, but there are other columns there.
The number of fountain, no, it's the number of elements.
Mm-hmm.
So if the signs average, let's say, 150 base pairs in length, then you have, what is it, the 2.1 billion, 210 million base pairs of signed DNA, all right? And since it's about 2.8 or 2.9 of the genome, billion in the genome, that gives you the figure of about 12%. Well, the estimate in this case is simply that only a certain percentage of the genome has been sequenced. Okay, and exactly, yeah. All right, and it may be, and I think it's almost certainly going to prove to be the case that the pieces which haven't been sequenced are going to be far richer in these elements than what has been sequenced. So that's likely to turn out to be an underestimate, unless, and I just don't remember how Anton, who's a postdoc with Wen-Chung Lee at Chicago, who's done a lot of work. I've borrowed one of his a recent seminar of his for a lot of this talk, because he's been working on this subject specifically. Now, one of the things to mention is that transposable elements, including, and in particular, sign elements, I said something about this yesterday, are taxonomically specific. All right, and so let me say something about that, and I'll come back to Anton's slide. So here's a generic sign element. It has an A box and a B box, which I think have to do with promoter activity, recognition by Pol3. They have these poly A tails on them and the sequence duplications. The ALU element, as I said, is a sort of partial duplication of the 7S RNA sequence. But if you look in another primate, the Galago, you find that you get a very specific kind of variant of this element. So this is an aspect of taxonomic specificity, and a point which will be quite important when we talk about the evolution of protein coding sequences is that primates have ALUs, but rodents don't have ALUs. They have these B elements, which are tRNA copies, and they're quite different from the ALUs. So this is our predominant sign. The rodents have these B elements. Rabbits have their own kind of sign elements. Goats and cows have a different kind of sign element. Salmon have other signs. You can identify, as I said, the species much more readily. If you take a hamster-human hybrid cell, which is often used in genetic studies because you lose certain human chromosomes, and you want to identify the human chromosomes, what you do is you just do an in situ hybridization with ALU, which hybridizes everywhere, and it lights up the human chromosomes, and it doesn't hybridize at all with the hamster chromosomes, and so you can distinguish them right away. And the fact that these elements are taxonomically specific means that there are going to be taxonomically specific genetic changes created as they move around. And this is part of what I mean by genome system architecture and how it's specific. Now, it turns out that what Anton studied was using the draft human sequence and also what was available of the mouse sequence. How many of the coding sequences contain segments of transposable elements? And does everybody know about repeat masker? You've talked about repeat masker here? No. All right, well, repeat masker is a program which allows you to filter out all of the repetitive elements when you're looking at various sequences, like coding sequences. And it's based on the idea, of course, that this is junk DNA and non-coding DNA. Repeat masker, though, also allows you to identify where in the coding sequences there are sequences homologous to repeats. So rather than using repeat masker for filtering, Anton used it to ask, in all of the coding sequences that have been well studied and well identified, not from the draft sequence, how many of them show unambiguous evidence of having segments which are derived from repeat elements in the genome? All right? And what he found was that at least 4% of all of the well-studied protein coding sequences have repeat elements in them. And it means that there are 2,000 genes, if you will, which are partially composed of these repeat elements. If they assume there's 50,000 genes in the genome, now that we think it's more like 30,000, it's about 1,200. But that's still quite significant. And let me just make one more point. Since these elements are moving around in history, these repeats will be present in the most recently evolved protein sequences in the species. Yeah. We're going to come to that question. They're mostly they're in exons because this is looking at the protein sequence itself. Okay. What we're going to see is that they come from insertions into introns, but then through splicing, part of the element itself is incorporated as an exon.
But if it's an exon, then sometimes if it's alpha helix, you have repeats of some repeatedly.
Well, can we come back to that when I talk, go through and show you how Anton's worked out where he thinks these things come from? Yeah.
How complicated is the control for transmission of these algorithms?
It's not entirely clear. It's a difficult thing to study. For example, there's a postdoc in Chicago who took cells and overexpressed BCL2 to prevent apoptosis. And then he found the DNA damaging treatments, which would ordinarily lead to apoptosis, so you couldn't study the cells. But in these cells, they didn't go apoptotic. They didn't go on to undergo programmed cell death. But there was a tremendous increase in the transcription of the sign elements of ALU. All right?
Is it like the control of other eukaryotic genes involving like 20?
Well, POL3 transcription tends to be rather simpler for signs, having fewer transcription factors. POL2 transcription, like for the line elements, is POL2 transcription. And I think a lot of it depends upon where the particular line element is located with respect to enhancer elements in the genome, how many factors may be involved in its transcription. Each element insertion, of course, is going to have a unique transcription pattern. Yeah, and there's...
Did you say that these transposable elements are taxon specific? Is that mean absolutely or at some level of resolution? In other words, is there some...
Oh, at some level of resolution. For example, line elements are found in all mammals. But as evolution proceeds, these elements undergo changes. And so certain families of line elements, certain sequence variants of it, are specific to rodents. Other sequence variants are specific to primates. Okay? It's the sign elements which seem to be most dramatically different between the different mammalian orders. All right? All primates have ALUs. You can do a primate phylogeny by looking at the sequence variants of ALUs. There are a lot of different families of them, and you can work that out. But rodents don't have ALUs at all.
But they have something similar.
But they have other signs,
yes.
Right, which fulfill that function. And I think that this is part of what's very important, and we'll see later how it plays a role in the evolution of species-specific proteins. Okay?
Real gene somewhere.
Yeah.
And then there's some line element why would the normal GMP transpire rather than the LIRM? I mean, they're all enhanced in the vicinity. What, there's so many more of these than a gene. Won't the outcome be canceled?
Well, they are transcribed.
But
I mean,
many more of them than the
I don't know the exact composition, but for example, in Drosophila, when recombinant DNA began, the first of these elements to be really identified was called copia. It's an LTR-containing retrotransposon, but it's called copia because it was the source of the most abundant or most copious RNA in Drosophila tissue culture cells. All right. Now, whether in the animal, you probably don't have nearly as much RNA synthesized. And we know from some experiments where you put promoters on these things and regulate them, that when you increase the transcription, you increase the transposition activity as well. Okay, because the RNA not only is the substrate for reverse transcription, but it also encodes the proteins which carry out the reverse transcription and insertion. Okay, so these elements are transcribed. There's a series of endogenous retroviruses in mice called intracisternal A particles, which are the source of one of the most abundant transcripts during early mouse embryonic development. So in early development, these elements are highly transcribed. Whether that has any developmental significance or not, I don't know. The RNAs, I don't think we can tell. I mean, that's a very complicated thing because you have to have some way of measuring the total number of messages made. I just couldn't say. I assume it's a relatively small fraction. The best place to study that is in yeast, where you can do the most quantitative experiments. But I don't know the direct answer. I mean, but you get maybe one, I just don't know. Because you can tremendously increase the transposition of TY elements when you transcribe them from a highly active regulated promoter. But what the numbers are, I don't know. And remember, when you do those experiments, if you had a very high rate of transposition, you could have lots of changes in the genome. And many of the cells where the process occurred would not be recoverable as viable cells able to form a colony. So it's a very difficult thing to quantitate. I don't say that it's impossible. And perhaps by direct examination of the DNA, not worrying about recovering viable cells, you can actually get an answer to that question. All right? Now, let me see. Okay, the TEs are taxon specific, as I mentioned and showed with the overhead. Here it says ALU signs and L1 group P, that's a subvariant of the line 1 element, are only found in primates. The B elements are only found in rodents. The majority of transposons found within human coding regions, that is when you do this search and you ask which elements, segments of which elements are present, are human or primate specific, meaning that these proteins, which contain segments from the transposable elements, only arose in the human or primate lineage. In other words, they are really an important part of what makes us us and different from mice and elephants. They do happen other places. Yeah, and I'm going to show you examples where they happen specifically in rodents. All right? But that's what makes a rodent, in part. I'm not saying it's the whole answer, but obviously if you have a taxonomically specific element and it is able to become part of protein coding sequences and create new proteins, new sequences of domains, those proteins will be taxonomically specific and will be part of the genetic change which makes that species what it is. I'm not going to say that transposable elements or retrotransposable elements explain all of evolution, but I think the evidence is undeniable that to a high degree, and that means when we look at the total amount of the DNA in our genomes, we are humans because of the action of these transposable elements. I think that's an undeniable conclusion from the draft sequence data, and it's certainly stated pretty clearly in the Nature paper. Yeah.
So how long have they researched in the coding range and believe for up the coding frame?
Well, we'll come to that. We'll look at them in more detail. Okay? There's some questions about how many amino acids that Anton could answer that I can't, but let's see how much information we have here. And it turns out, it says here, that even widely distributed elements such as L1, the line element, are going to be in different amounts and in different sequence classes in different elements. Okay, now, let's look mechanistically at how line elements can carry out the kind of changes in protein coding sequences that yesterday's talk told us must be happening if we're going to have reassortment of coding domains as our source of innovation in protein synthesis. And there is a whole series of studies, by the way, of regulatory regions and asking how many of those could be derived from, say, ALUs or other things. And Jürgen Brosius in Germany and Roy Britton in this country have gone through and analyzed, and every year more and more examples are found where regulatory elements are partly composed of transposed ALUs, for example, in the human genome. There are dozens of cases now. I'm sure that in the end it will turn out to be hundreds and even more. And of course, when they've happened very long ago in evolution, they're very hard to trace anymore because there's been too much sequence divergence since then. Now, it turns out that when a line 1 element is transcribed, it doesn't always stop at the end, at the 3' prime end of the line element. This red blob here indicates where the poly-A addition signal or poly-A sequence will be at the end of that L1 element. But RNA termination doesn't happen with 100% efficiency, and so transcription can continue to another sequence which terminates transcription and leads to poly-A addition. And a downstream segment of chromosomal sequence can be picked up and incorporated into the RNA molecule. When that is then reverse transcribed, remember it's the 3' prime end which is most commonly found. The 5' prime end can be truncated. You frequently get either the complete line element plus the adjacent chromosomal DNA integrated as a new element, or you have the 3' prime chromosomal DNA and a part of the line element inserted, flanked by the sequence duplication and having the poly-A tail. And this is a mechanism for moving adjacent sequence information from the chromosomes from one place to another. And here are some examples from this paper where they had elements, 10 elements in this class where they had 889 to 975 base pair of adjacent DNA sequence transduced. Here 52 to 356, and here 7 to 28 transduced. And I'm not sure I know, could tell you exactly why those are class 1, 2, and 3. I just picked up the paper and picked up the data. Now, it has been proven experimentally that this is a mechanism of moving protein coding domains around, and that's shown in this paper. It's really quite an exciting paper. So here is a line 1 element with its ORF1, and here's ORF2 with the reverse transcriptase. I'm not sure what C is. This is endonuclease domain. And this has been genetically engineered to contain the sequence for a neomycin phosphotransferase. That is an antibiotic resistance sequence which will phosphorylate antibiotics like neomycin and inactivate them. And that's used because mammalian cells in tissue culture, human cells and rodent cells, are sensitive to a neomycin-like antibiotic called G418. But if the cells have a complete sequence for making this phosphotransferase, then they are resistant. The antibiotic inhibits the ribosomes, as I understand it, in the mitochondrion, not the mammalian ribosomes. Because mitochondrial ribosomes are bacteria-like and are sensitive to antibiotics which work on bacteria. Now, this coding sequence for the resistance is in the inverted orientation, so it's not going to be translated off of this RNA. It'll be the wrong strand. It contains two splice sites, a splice donor and a splice acceptor site in the DNA, so that when this is transcribed and then processed, the sequence is put together and becomes an intact sequence. It's still facing the wrong way. It has a downstream poly A addition, termination poly A addition signal. And then over here in the right orientation is a poly A signal from the SV40 virus. Okay? So this RNA gets transcribed and spliced. You have this neo sequence here. It cannot be transcribed. There's no promoter here. And it can't be translated since it's in the wrong orientation in the RNA. But when this is inserted into the DNA, if you have a promoter up here, you can transcribe and then terminate transcription here. And if you then start splicing, this can be incorporated as a domain in the protein, which is being made from this promoter and this transcript. And if this is made, the cells become resistant to the antibiotic. And what happens is that when you put this plasmid into cells, transcribe it, and then look at, plate out the cells and look for G418 resistance, you find them. And what you find is, we're now looking at from this end, going left to right, that they're inserted downstream of some native promoter. Here are a series of exons, and then all of a sudden, the splicing occurs, and there's a splice acceptor signal here, so that the neo coding sequence becomes an exon, and the cells make a hybrid protein, where this is the last domain of the protein, and the cells become resistant to the antibiotic. And this was an experimental proof that this kind of transduction can in fact affect domain shuffling and the adding of new domains to proteins. Does everybody follow that?
Yeah, but this usually wouldn't work if you inserted it in the RNA. So how does it know?
This only has to be inserted into an intron in the proper orientation for this to work.
Yeah, but not if you actually combine two domains.
So yeah.
Some exons and another exon.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to, all the, no, the reading frame has to be correct with the splice sites and so forth. So that means that one of six insertions into an intron is going to be okay. Three of them are going to be in the wrong orientation, and two of the three are going to be in the wrong reading frame.
So, for example, if we insert this into a gene which goes for a membrane protein,
No, because if this is the last domain, actually, the rest of the protein can be inserted into the membrane, and this will just stick out as a tail on the cytoplasm, and it will be active. And the point is that it's not a question of what the efficiency is. Can it happen? Does it work? And the answer to that question is yes, it does work. And you can recover thousands of examples of this.
Yeah, so I guess my question is that is this insertion completely stochastic process or is it sometimes guided?
We're going to come to that question. All right? I'm not a great believer in randomness or stochasticity in biological systems. And biological systems are not great believers in it either, because obviously they don't want to go chaotic and they don't want to have random events. That's why they're so complex and have so many layers of regulation. Now, what Anton did, again, to get some numbers, and we've seen the numbers, he looked at this Unigene database, which is about 14,000 coding regions that have been very well studied and don't have all of the possibilities of errors and so forth of a lot of the coding regions in the draft genome. These have been carefully studied. And he found that they had segments inside the coding sequence in out of these 13,000, almost 200, 196, had sequences inside the coding sequence of the protein, that is, protein sequences which matched the translation of sign or line elements with the probability that it could not be a chance match. Generally, these had an E value of several orders, of negative several orders of magnitude. Sometimes the TE-derived sequence contained the start signal for translation of the protein, the ATG, and sometimes they contained the stop codon. And when you added those all together, there were 533, which is about 4% of those sequences. So that's where the 4% number came from in the previous slide. Now, how do transposable elements end up in coding sequences? And there are two ways this can happen. One is you can have the direct insertion into an exon, and the inserted piece of DNA can become part of the exon itself and staying in frame. Am I getting too obscure and losing people because of that? Okay, let's take a break. This is a good place to stop right now. Why don't we get started, because there's still more to cover, and in some ways the best is yet to come, okay? And one of the things I was thinking, I want to reemphasize, I'm only telling you a part of what these systems are and what cells can do with their DNA. I'm leaving out a number of examples. It just isn't time to discuss them all, and there are probably many more situations that haven't been studied yet where other quite remarkable things happen. Okay, so let's come back to now looking at the movement of these retrotransposons. And TE means transposable element. So the element can insert directly in the exon and extend the exon. Or the transposon can be an exon, or part of the transposon can be an exon, insert into an intron, and then be spliced into the final messenger RNA. And when Anton looked at this and asked, at 306 exons that he identified, which proteins where he had sequences, only about 10% had the transposable element inserted inside the exon itself, which makes sense. That's a lot more difficult. There's more degrees of freedom in the splicing mechanism. So generally, in 90% of the cases, transposable elements are introduced into protein coding regions by being recruited as novel exons. All right, and this addresses this other question which came up, exons and domains, okay, and how things evolve and how proteins get put together. Now, this is simply to show that there are both 5' splice junctions and 3' splice junctions present in the ALU sequence in one or the other orientation. But there's no 3' splice junctions here. So you would have to have, if you're inserted, if the ALU is inserted left to right in a coding sequence, this piece of the ALU could be incorporated, or perhaps all of it up to here, but I don't know what's in this sequence here in the different reading frames in the way of stop codons and so forth. All right? In this reading frame, you can be spliced in multiple ways and get multiple segments of the ALU incorporated into your protein. Now, there are various ways that the transposable elements insertions can affect the coding sequence. And this is a slide which in part is intended to show that some of these things can be species specific as well. So one thing is that just inserting a transposable element and then part of it becoming an exon, you extend the transcript and you extend the coding sequence. And if that element, I presume that the reason that species B doesn't show anything is simply that that element is not present and can't insert into that intron in species B. Sometimes you insert an element and it now can become the start site for translation. And if it has a spliced donor site, then it can become the first exon of a novel protein, which encodes, which includes these exons here. And again, this event, if this is an element which is only found in one species, it wouldn't occur here. Sometimes, and this is the case with that experimental system that I showed you with the neomycin, the TE segment can be spliced in, and then it contains a stop signal, either for translation or for transcription. And so you get a 3' truncated protein that is made with a different piece. And sometimes the same element can be inserted, but is spliced differently using different spliced donor and acceptor sites in two different species. Yeah?
If you were to put in a transposable element insertion in such a way, the previous gene is also there in all of the forms and things like that. So it means that if you were to skip over that, exon would be perfectly valid. So it seems like this would be a natural mechanism for having alternative splice sites and such. Is there any correlation between TE insertions and alternative splicing?
Remember, this has just been discovered. This paper has not yet been accepted for publication. All right. So I mean, I think that's a very good question. And if you were to ask me, well, what would I think? I would say, well, sure, of course. And we have more TEs. We have more alternative splicing. And we.
The mice actually have lots of TEs also.
But not as many as we do.
Not as many as we do. Okay.
All right? And they have different ones, which will have different properties. We'll come to that in a second. Of course, that's possible. And I'm sure if it's possible, it happens. All right? We do know, by the way, for example, some of the DNA transposons, the AC element in maize, which is a DNA transposon, can also, the sequence can be correctly spliced out of the RNA. All right, so it can insert, it can give alternative splice sites, but it can also be just excised, and even though it goes into a coding sequence, an exon, it doesn't necessarily cause a disruptive or a knockout mutation. It may alter the regulation. All right, and that's one of the original ones that McClintock discovered. So the splicing gives tremendous flexibility, and of course that's the major lesson of the human draft human genome, that with using splicing and alternative splicing is how you can get a much larger proteome. And I think that that's extremely important. Now, these are the different possibilities. You create new start, you just extend the protein, you make new starts, you make new stops, and then you get alternative splicing. Yeah?
I'm a little confused. So when these pieces are inserted, they are only part of that gene, right?
No, the if you look at the first one, you see this whole thing, this say is a whole ALU element. Okay? Yeah. But only splice sites here and here are used, so what ends up in the final mRNA is only a piece of the ALU. Okay?
Which is much shorter than the ALU.
Well, it's shorter, yeah. Okay, so it's only encoding a segment of proteins, of the protein. Because you have to use the splice sites, and in an ALU, the splice sites are internal. They're not at the ends. On these proteins, you know it from, this is known from the protein sequence.
Oh, from the protein sequence.
Yeah, now I presume the protein sequence is derived from a cDNA. That's generally the way we have it. Yeah. Okay, so you've got the sequence of a protein, and you find that there is a segment in the protein, all right, which matches with a probability that means it cannot be a chance match to an amino acid sequence encoded by a repeat element. That's how we pick these up.
Do you have statistics of the density of the Q-values of these matrices?
I don't have them. Anton sent me the manuscript. I can give you his email, and I'm sure he would be interested in communicating with you about it. Okay? Remember, this, as I said, this is unpublished work. Now, what he says is, here are examples of each of the four classes that have actually been discovered. So there's an RNA-specific adenosine deaminase, which contains a segment of ALU-J. This is one of the subfamilies of the ALU element. There's a rat sodium channel containing an L1-derived exon that's expressed in the nervous system. And I think that's interesting. We'll see some more sodium channels. Of course, ion channels are involved in behavior. And a couple weeks ago, I got an email from a student in England who'd read a paper of mine about transposable elements and evolution, and he was excited, and he says, well, can they have anything to do with the evolution of behavior? And I said, well, I don't think we know much about the evolution of behavior. I don't know anything about this. You might look up some of Seymour Benzer's papers and so forth. And I sent back the email. That afternoon was when I went to this class and heard Anton present this work. And all of a sudden, I saw sodium channels, ion channels, being made up in part of transposable elements. And I sent the kid another email saying, wait a minute. Ion channels, which affect nerve function and behavior, can be made up in part of transposable elements. So maybe they do play a direct role in behavioral evolution, certainly in evolution of the nervous system. Yeah?
There's going to be zillions of these retroviruses. Any insight why ALU or a few others that wouldn't have picked up
by us? Why it was picked up by us?
Yeah.
Well, that's part of my hypothesis, if you will, that each group has its own system architecture, and that the content of signs is a characteristic of the system architecture. It may have to do with how the various recombination machinery and so forth of the cell handles all of these dispersed repeats. It may have to, and it influences the evolutionary potential of the organism. All right, and as I say, it's part of what makes each organism and each group rather unique.
Is there anything special So if you check, say, the six possible reading frames, and then for the amino acid sequence of code,
I don't know. I mean, I just know what Anton gave me about the splice sites in it. Let me finish this.
Well, let me just thank you. I like stochasticity more than you do, but I'm thinking that you have random fixation. And so if you have, as in your class today, if you go back a number of generations, so you think everything will have a common answer.
So why so many? You need to have a 10 times more.
It sort of could be that it's just working its way for instrumental fixation. That if you have competition, you have an advantage that eventually.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
But even if you have a numerical advantage rather than functional advantage, there's still random fixation.
I think, let me just. I think this is something we can come back to. It's a very important point. But the thing which has always struck me about signs and mammalian orders is, why don't all mammalian orders have mixtures of all signs? Why are they so taxonomically specific? And clearly there's no intention to say, okay, we're going to evolve a human being, therefore let's put an allo into the primates and we'll end up with a human being. However, there may be something about allos and the potential it gives primates for evolution, which has something to do with the way primates have evolved. And that rodents, because they have a different class of these things, can evolve along different pathways. All right? Now, I know that the evolutionists will hate this. They call this sort of thing orthogenesis. But I think that, you know, evolution is a process of working with what you have and trying to create something new. And the point that Anton is trying to make in this talk, and that I think fits with my idea, is that each group has rather distinct potentials for what can happen to it. And it may be that that has a lot to do with the various courses that evolution has taken in different taxonomic groups. Okay? Clearly, there's something non-random about sign expansion, because you just don't find a mixture of all the possible signs in all the organisms.
You wouldn't expect to have that anyway. I mean, if you inherited the diversity, you would think as long as you wait long enough, eventually one will dominate.
I don't like long time either. I think it's a kind of deus ex machina that's been used. But anyway, let's go on with some facts. And I want to come back to the issue of specificity of action of these things too, and it's going to take a few minutes. So premature stops. Here's another behavioral kind of thing: a protein, an enzyme which converts serotonin to melatonin. You get a mutant in mice. I guess they have, these are mutants which have a distorted reproductive cycle, and a DNA transposon is inserted and caused early termination of this protein so that it's not being made. Here's a transcription factor, or actually a kinase, a protein kinase activator, where the 3' end comes from an allo element. All right, in the human, in the signal transduction pathways leading to blood cells. This triphosphatase for an oxidized form of guanosine. It's involved in repair processes and preventing this from being incorporated. And an endogenous retrovirus can insert in the 5' region and give different possible start sites. Okay. Now, I think this says that there's not a lot known about what the possibilities are. There's a sign element called MIR, which is mammalian interspersed repeat, that's found in all mammals. So it's mammal-wide. And both the human and mouse genes for the fibroblast growth factor have two exons derived from this. And fibroblast growth factor is a very important cell regulatory molecule. It says, though, that the pieces inserted are spliced differentially in mice and in humans. This apparently is one event, which occurred before mice and humans diverged. But the splicing apparatus, or the splicing architecture, as I was talking about yesterday, is distinct in the two organisms. So you actually get different growth factors produced in mice and in humans, because the splicing is different. Yeah?
I have two questions. If you look at human and mouse genes, many of the genes seem to be highly mutable.
Right.
Which are taken, right? So I don't understand what are the adults doing.
Alu elements are specific to primates. Okay, now, if the primate is going to evolve, one of the things it needs to do is to make distinct proteins. How is it going to do that? The traditional way is that you have base changes and you modify the proteins gradually, even if you duplicate them and have one copy which is more mobile. A much more rapid way of modifying the proteins is to insert a large piece of DNA and add a whole new domain or segment to that protein.
But where is the evidence for this? I
mean, well, here, right here. Well, it turns out that there is evidence in 4% of human genes, which I think is a pretty significant percentage, for this having happened. And we don't know yet how many differences there are that make a human different from a mouse. They're likely not to be as much in the proteins themselves. I think everybody agrees that this is in the regulatory regions, because we and mice are fairly similar. All right? We're very similar, in fact. It's differences in development, differences in the amount and the size of organs and tissues and so forth, which really make a lot of the differences between us. It may be that there are certain key protein changes, which are specific, have to do with behavior, for example, or metabolism and reproduction, which are quite significant in evolution. And all this is saying is that these things are clearly possible and have clearly happened in evolution. All right? And these are differences between mice. We'll see in a second differences between mice and humans, because if you have a new protein formed in which part of it is encoded by an alu element, it could not have formed in a rodent, because rodents don't have alus. And if you have a protein formed because it has pieces of it coming from these B elements, it couldn't have formed in a human. It's going to be a rodent-specific protein. And there are clearly going to be things which distinguish rodents from primates or rodents from humans. You know, that's... Yeah. Well, I didn't say that the whole difference. I just said a large part of the difference. Our genome differs from the mouse genome by having a lot of extra DNA in it. And at least half of our DNA, more than half of our DNA, is repetitive and mobile elements. So if we've got a lot more DNA than mice, certainly mobile and repetitive elements are responsible for a lot of that increase. Secondly, we have some proteins that are different. And if they're proteins which can uniquely evolve in primates and not evolve in rodents, they're going to be part of what makes us different from a mouse. That's what I was saying. I don't think there's anything illogical about that. It might be shocking to some people. I guess they would rather have, you know.
Shocking. I'm just trying to understand how much.
I think we don't know how much yet, because we haven't looked for these things.
Right.
This is unpublished results. All right, we know that these things are possible. That's well documented. That's one of the reasons it's taking long for these guys to get this published. It's how extensive it is.
I mean, I guess when would it?
But can we go forward? Because I want to cover some more points, and I'm not going to have time to do it and free everybody for lunch. Now, you have your next session at 3 o'clock this afternoon?
Yeah.
So we can go a little bit longer than noon. And, all right. Because I really would like to do it. Now, I want to give you an example here that Anton gave of two rodent-specific proteins. One is a chemokine, a signaling molecule. I apologize for not being familiar with the biology of the molecule, where the protein is terminated in an LTR, which is a rodent-specific endogenous retrovirus LTR. So this is a cell signaling molecule which could not have formed in primates, did form in a mouse, in a rodent, and that's a rodent-specific protein. Here's a non-selective cation channel whose sequence is largely composed of pieces of different sign elements, rodent-specific sign elements. And this cation channel, which works, it's been studied physiologically, all the biochemistry has been done, is made up, apparently, of multiple insertion events of different sign elements that are rodent-specific. This protein is not found in the human genome. That protein is not found in the human genome. They are part of what distinguishes the mouse proteome from the human proteome. Okay? And they have clearly evolved by the participation of these reverse transcribed elements. Okay? I mean, it's just a fact. And it's a fact which then has to be incorporated in our thinking of how do mice evolve and how do we evolve. Well, I think what it says is people have to do more research on this and do that. I don't think it's necessarily a numbers game because I don't know. I presume that nobody's made a knockout of that channel. It would be interesting to know what a knockout of that channel or a knockout of that signaling molecule, that chemokine, what it does and how important it is to the development or the behavior of the mouse.
I guess to address Nicholas's question is that eventually people are going to do cross-genome comparison of all the proteins.
Yeah.
It's a mouse and human. Let's look at how many of them are different, how many differences are attributed by this kind of mechanism.
Sure.
To answer the question. So,
yeah.
How many are mouse-specific genes?
Well, I don't know. In this case, I don't know if you can read this. This says this is B3, B1, B4. There's three different ones. B1, B3, and B4. So three different ones have made this up.
Okay, but in this gene, in general?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
And
all right?
Two B1s are the same segments, or they're shifted?
Well, one looks like it comes from an element oriented one way and one from an element oriented the other way. Okay, so they're going to be quite different amino acid sequences. Whether those are exactly the same segments, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. Okay? But I think when I heard this is quite a startling result. Okay? And I extrapolate a little bit from what we know about prokaryotes, that they have evolved largely through the action of natural genetic engineering, cutting and splicing rearrangements, rather than through gradual change. And also the fact that if my ideas about how genomes are organized as systems, where you have modules which are linked together, like exons, then a lot of evolution is going to involve domain swapping, and I think everybody agrees that that's how some of these different taxonomically specific different regulatory factors have come about. And perhaps these elements or DNA elements are involved in the rearrangements which give you domain swapping and create new structures for transcription factors. Now, a key point is that we're not dealing with stochastic events here. We're dealing with regulated events. This is very important because we know that cells and genomes are filled with the capacity to make the genome highly unstable. And yet genomes function, and they function reliably. And in the, unfortunately, in the cases I was going to talk about, like the immune system and the ciliates, the instability can be quite great, but it's highly regulated too, so that it works functionally for the organism. And one of the things is that we know that all of these natural genetic engineering activities are controlled, are regulated, so that there are going to be times when they're not functioning and the genome is going to be stable. And there are times when they are going to be turned on and the genome will be unstable. And so in these systems, like the immune system and the ciliates, where it's part of the regular life cycle, it's the developmental control of those organisms which regulates the ability of those cells to rearrange their DNA. These systems can be turned on and off. That's very important. The TY3 LTR type of retrotransposon in yeast is actually activated during mating. And it's activated during mating because it contains a pheromone response element in its LTR so that it is transcribed specifically during the mating event. And during mating, you get more transposition events. There's the phenomenon of adaptive mutation that I told you about yesterday. That is where transposable elements are activated by starvation stress in microorganisms or by other stresses which prevent growth. We know that osmotic stress, fungal toxins will activate plant elements which are normally inactive in the plant genome. We know that when DNA damage occurs, systems like the SOS system are turned on. These are partly repair systems, but since it also contains mutator polymerases, it's also a mutator system. And this makes base changes. And when DNA breakage occurs, a double-strand break occurs, mobile elements are activated. This is what McClintock did by having repeated chromosome breakages. And she called it genome shock, that when the reproduction of the genome is interfered with, that often these systems which can restructure the genome are activated so that the genome has a way of escaping from those problems. A very important kind of stress, and I think it's going to be extremely important in evolution, is hybridization between different populations or different species. And for example, if you cross two species of nematodes, or two strains of Caenorhabditis elegans, excuse me, one of which has hundreds of these TC1 DNA elements in its chromosomes, and one which has very few elements, you find that the TC1 elements are activated and you get many mutations in the chromosomes of the species which didn't have the elements to start with. That's also true of this phenomenon in Drosophila, called hybrid dysgenesis. You have populations which have the elements and that are active and populations which don't. And when you cross them, you get a great deal of genetic instability. PM is a system which uses DNA transposons. IR is a system which uses line elements. So those can both be regulated. When different strains of mice or different species of wallabies are crossed, retroviruses are activated and restructuring of the chromosomes occur. In particular, you get great expansion, chromosome rearrangements and centromere expansions with lots of insertions of retroviruses in these wallabies. This is a paper that was recently published. And if you hybridize different species of Nicosiana, you find that a lot of the repeat DNA all of a sudden undergoes tremendous expansion. There's a lot more amplification of this DNA. You can actually see it in the microscope looking at the chromosomes. So that putting chromosomes into novel environments, into novel architectures, as I would like to put it, can actually turn on or activate or de-repress elements which in their original cellular and chromosomal environment were not active.
So rather than interpreting this as a regulated thing where they say, oh gee, I need to change now because whatever I'm doing is not working that well, one other interpretation would be that these things are just being optimistic. They're saying, gee, the cell's under a lot of stress, it's distracted, and I'll take advantage of this opportunity to
be
more of myself.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you can look at a lot of things in different ways. I don't think one necessarily has to choose. I didn't like the selfish DNA idea for a long time. But when I discovered, you know, I really learned about Agrobacterium plasmids, which not only control the behavior of the bacteria, but the behavior of the plant, so that more not only the bacteria can proliferate, but there's more transfer of the plasmids. I said that this is really selfish DNA. This is the plasmid controlling the whole system. And if that helps you understand it, fine. What I'm trying to say is that we need to think about evolution as a more systematic, more of an engineering process. And what the ultimate teleological goals of the DNA segments or the organisms may be, I think is a little bit irrelevant. You know, you can say that the cell is the gene's way of making more cell, but you can also say that the cell is the tRNA's way of making more tRNA. And I don't think that one can say that one statement is more sensible than the other. It just depends upon your a priori opinions about the importance of DNA and the importance of tRNA. And you could say the same thing about lipids. What I'm trying to document here is that we can understand a lot about evolution and how it occurs, and we can solve a lot of problems, in particular the problem of why genomes are stable when they're stable, and why they change and can change very rapidly when they do, by looking at these cases of regulation. What the ultimate source of the regulation is, I'm not so concerned about. I think of it as a system, an integrated system, and it functions, and one of its outputs is evolutionary change. And I think that given the fact that we know that life is a history of survival and competition and evolution and so forth, I don't have any trouble saying that the major impetus is to provide that potential for change. But one can look at it differently and do that. I think the problem with explaining all of these things by the selfish DNA idea is it prevents you from looking at the real utility that these systems have for generating evolutionary novelty. Okay?
Yeah, I see that. It's existing as sort of a standard, and then we have these things occurring for other reasons, and have to take a role in the
If evolution occurs by engineering, aren't engineers great opportunists? Right? Don't they take advantage of things that come along and incorporate them and so forth? And so we can think of the evolutionary process as being opportunistic in the same way, perhaps. All right, let's come now to the final point, which is that these, I hope I've demonstrated is that these systems can do all of the nuts and bolts engineering and changes of the DNA that need to be made in, and that have been made in evolution, that we know have been made in evolution. That these systems are regulated so that they can serve more effectively this evolutionary role, whatever the basis for the regulation might be. And the third thing is that they act in a non-random way. And part of their non-randomness is simply that the events of moving defined pieces of DNA around is itself a highly non-random process, even if the targets are chosen in a completely random fashion. But in fact, the targets are never chosen in a non-random fashion, and what we are accumulating is evidence that there's a lot of specificity in the choice of targets, and as I'll show you in a few minutes, that specificity can be connected to the control of transcription. All right? And that, I think, is a very profound significance. So, we know, and I have a slide on this, but we don't have to look at it, that TY1 through 4, these retroviral-like elements in yeast have an incredible specificity for inserting upstream of Pol3 transcription start sites. And with the TY3 element, it has been shown by in vitro studies that part of this targeting involves interaction of the Pol3 integration system, of the TY3 integration system, excuse me, with Pol3 transcription factors. All right? So they actively interact. And from a molecular point of view, this shouldn't be surprising. Here are proteins which recognize specific regions in the DNA. Here are proteins which act on the DNA. Why shouldn't they interact in such a way that you give specificity to the system? There's nothing mysterious in a molecular biology sense about that. But the implications of that, of course, are extremely powerful in terms of thinking about more efficient ways of changing the genome to modify co-regulated and functionally integrated systems. The TY1 element, like many elements, does not insert into coding sequences very often. It, in fact, inserts upstream of Pol2 transcripts when it's not inserting upstream of Pol3 transcripts. And in insertion of these elements outside of the coding sequence enhances their role in changing transcription patterns and not in disrupting coding sequences. And if you have a yeast function and you have a way of selecting for overexpression of it, one of the most frequent classes, or perhaps the most frequent class of mutation which is found, is a 5' upstream insertion of a TY element, and the enhancers in the LTRs of the TY element boost expression of that particular function. Yeah? All right, these are different RNA polymerases. So messenger RNAs and line elements and retroviruses are all transcribed by Pol2. Small RNAs like tRNAs and 7S RNA and sine elements are all transcribed by Pol3. Okay? Stable RNAs tend to be transcribed by Pol3. The TY5 element has a different specificity from TY1 through 4, And it specifically inserts into silenced regions of the yeast genome. And later, if anybody wants, I can show you an overhead of this with some of the data. And the thing is, that in silenced regions, a specific chromatin structure has been developed. And the way this specificity is understood is, again, the integration apparatus of TY5 interacts with the proteins in the silencing complex to target the element for the silenced regions of the genome. P factors prefer to insert in the 5' ends of transcripts. This is something I just found a few days ago as I was preparing the talk. But we know that P factors, the Drosophila DNA transposons, can be targeted to specific regions of the Drosophila genome by incorporating 5' regulatory sequences. And let me just show you that on an overhead. This was discovered a number of years ago in the early 90s, and I think it's a tremendously important discovery, but people haven't followed up on it. They know that they can have targeting, but nobody says, wow, this might change the way we think about specificity of what's going on. So here's an example. This was actually one of the first reports from Tom Kornberg's laboratory, where they for genetic engineering in Drosophila, you put pieces of DNA inside the inverted repeats of a TY element. This is actually a circular molecule. So here's one end and here's the other end, and it goes around like this. And if you have the 5' regulatory region of the engrail locus, what you find is that out of, I forget what the numbers are here, I think it may be in the legend, they had 20 independent insertions into the genome, and of those 35%, or 7, went to different sites in the engrailed region. It's not going in by homology, it's not recombining in through this sequence, because it goes into different sites. But here are the 7 insertions, okay, so they go into different positions here. But they have been targeted to that region. This is a highly non-random insertion process. And then later, and what I think is even more exciting result, a group in France. Yeah. A piece of the 5' untranslated region of the engrailed locus. Yeah, and upstream regulatory sequences. We can look and see. Maybe we can see how much it will say in here exactly. It just gives us the restriction sites, and I don't know whether this is drawn to scale. Okay, I mean, LAC-Z is about 3,000 base pairs in length, so this may be 5 or 6 or 8 kilobases, okay, in that case. But much smaller pieces do this, as we'll see in a second. Okay, I can give you the reference and everything for the paper. The P factor itself is highly non-random in where it inserts in the genome by itself. For example, it has a hot spot in the singed locus, and this is a germline-specific element, and the singed locus is involved in making the egg coat, as well as making bristles. So now here is a paper from France, as I said, by Fauvarc and Dura, who are in Orsay. And what they did was, here's the polyhomeotic locus. This encodes a protein which is involved in regulating homeobox clusters, and it's related to polycomb. And so here is the RNA part here, and here's the splice, and here's where the translation starts here. So they can take either this segment here or this segment here and put it inside of a P factor and then they insert into the genome. And here are the insertions that they recovered, and what they find is a very high correlation among the insertions with cytological location correlated where either polyhomeotic or polycomb proteins bind to the chromosomes. And this is very far from a random distribution. And I think it's quite exciting if it turns out that what this means is there's an interaction between these transcriptional regulatory proteins, which we know can direct the transcriptional apparatus to specific sites in the genome, and this transposable element, this mobile element, and that the same protein-protein kind of interactions can direct the element to specific locations. Because since these elements transpose often with a frequency well above 100% and can make chromosome rearrangements in many insertions, it means now that a group of different chromosome regions, which are related to each other in a regulatory sense, can be related to each other in a mutational sense as well. And that may be part of the secret of making coordinated changes in the genome involving different loci in different positions. I think that's really extraordinarily exciting. And then finally, we have a few other examples. We know that there are retrotransposons which specifically transpose to the telomeres of Drosophila. Drosophila does not use telomerase to extend its telomeres. It uses retrotransposition to do that. And that's functional targeting. And there are elements which insert specifically in Bombyx mori, that is the silkworm, insert specifically in the ribosomal RNA region. So we have a lot of examples of different kinds of specificities and non-randomness in the movements of these elements. And I would say that from what I know of all the studies of different transposable elements, that the default assumption should not be randomness or uniformity, but actually non-randomness and some kind of specificity. Well, let me just summarize here and then stop, and maybe there'll be some discussion. We see that the genomic systems can, and I think must have been, built up by modular assembly of various components by some form of natural genetic engineering. Certainly, if you recall the slide on transcription factors I showed yesterday from the draft genome sequence, human genome sequence, clearly different domains are rearranged and spliced together, and that's not going to occur by gradual base changes. That's going to occur by cut and splice evolution. I was not able to show you all of the evidence, but it is on the PowerPoint presentation, which I can leave, that organisms are capable of restructuring the whole genome in a single cell or organismal generation. And McClintock, too, has published examples of that in maize. Natural genetic engineering functions are regulated, whatever the underlying psychology of the regulation is, so that they can be activated at moments of crisis.
The regulation implies a regulator, that's why I'm unhappy with that.
But in the case of the mu phage that I've studied, I told you what some of the regulatory molecules are.
I agree with that.
Well, but no, but I'm just telling you that there is not a case that I know of where it's been studied of a transposable element that is not subject to one form of regulation or another. Let's come back. Let me finish. Because what? Sure. And so they can be activated at moments of crisis. They have non-random target specificity, and that means that somehow related functions can be altered together when there's a high level of activity to construct new systems that are distributed through the genome, And that's why I think some of these results on P factor targeting in Drosophila are very exciting. And again, I didn't tell you this, I mentioned it yesterday in the hybrid dysgenesis case. We know that these changes can occur specifically premeiotically in the germline, so that you can have many gametes which share multiple changes and can create interbreeding populations capable of propagating major restructurings of the genome. And I would say that the sequence evidence, the genomics evidence, is all in favor of this view of evolution and not in favor of the gradualist view, because we know, for example, so much depends upon duplications. And those are events that have to occur rapidly. They are biochemically complex, whatever the mechanism might be. They can be mediated by dispersed homology. They can be mediated by the action of these mobile elements. They can be mediated by breakage and rejoining of chromosomes, either homologous rejoining or non-homologous rejoining. But those are all biochemically complex processes which have to be carried out by the cell themselves. And clearly, systems are present in the cells to ensure survival. And you can't say that rejoining of broken chromosomes is an accident. That's the positive action of a system which is there to ensure the survival of the organism. Okay, and I think that's enough philosophy and everything. So I've given you the basic message. Thanks.